Live and Let Spy, today, Thursday, November 7th. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Every day we're learning the extent to which spying touches our lives. We'll dissect the world of surveillance with a spy novelist.
I think that, you know, the people out there who said that, you know, that the panopticon is real have been right.
Turns out reality and fiction are not as far apart as you think. Also today, a reporter's quest to find the elusive Spanish Banksy, Señor X.
I had to lift up a fence. I had to slide underneath. I've just walked across about 200 yards of rubble.
Plus, high school students in South Africa come face to face with a ban on inappropriate hairstyles.
It creates the idea with the kids that they cannot come with street culture into the school.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, supporting the American Diabetes Association in their effort to prevent and cure diabetes and to improve the lives of all people affected by diabetes. You can test your risk for diabetes at StopDiabetesNow.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. As extremist credentials go, the Pakistani Taliban's new leader comes well-armed. Mullah Fazlullah is the man behind the shooting of young Pakistani activist Malala Yousafzai last year, and he's long had a reputation for being ruthless. 5 years ago, Fazlullah led a campaign through Pakistan's Swat Valley, where his men beheaded and flogged people in public and burned schools. Declan Walsh is the New York Times Pakistan bureau chief. Who is Mullah Fazlullah, Declan, and what can you tell us about him and his past?
Fazlullah is one of Pakistan's most famous Taliban commanders. He comes from the Swat Valley. That's a part of the northwest of the country where the Pakistan army engaged in a very serious offensive against the Taliban in 2009 in response to an effective Taliban takeover of that district. Over the last number of years, the Taliban have been on the run, but they've carried out a number of attacks, most famously against Malala Yousafzai, the teenage education activist who was shot in the head by militants. Mr. Fazlullah, who ostensibly was responsible for that attack, has now been made the head of the Taliban.
Right. So, I mean, Malala was the most high profile of Fazlullah-led attacks, but just one of many. I mean, remind us what else he's kind of led in terms of violent campaigns in the Swat Valley.
He's someone who combines a sort of flair for publicity. When he came into the Swat Valley, he was famously riding a white horse. He came to prominence through a pirate radio station. He sort of broadcast his message across the Swat Valley using this illegal radio station, but also cemented a reputation for ruthlessness and violence. The Taliban abducted and killed many perceived enemies when they were in control in Swat. They shut down girls' schools in the valley. And Mr. Fazlullah himself has been thought to be hiding across the border from Swat and from Pakistan in the mountains of eastern Afghanistan, orchestrating these guerrilla attacks on Pakistani forces.
So Fazlullah is a pretty violent individual. His predecessor, Hakimullah Massoud, was killed last Friday when U.S. drones hit his car. How was his death seen by the Pakistani government and Pakistanis?
His death was greeted with great anger by the Pakistani government and indeed the broader political establishment. Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif's government said that it had been on the verge of starting peace talks with Hakimullah Massoud just when that American drone strike occurred. Mr. Sharif's officials said that that they regretted that this drone strike had taken place and that they felt that Massoud was someone who they could do business with. So even though this was a man who had orchestrated many attacks in Pakistan cities that had killed probably thousands of civilians over the years, paradoxically, the Pakistani government felt that now was not, if you like, the right time to kill him.
So is there any sense of how the Pakistani government feels about this new leader, Mullah Fazlullah?
There's been no official reaction just yet, but they're not likely to be very pleased because Mullah Fazlullah has a history of reneging on peace deals with the government, if that's indeed what they still seek at this stage. And indeed, in the last couple of hours, since his leadership has been announced, the Taliban spokesman has come out and said that he will not be engaging in any peace deal with any peace negotiations with the Pakistani government, and that the Taliban will now concentrate its forces on carrying out some sort of retaliatory attack for Mr. Massoud's death. probably in Punjab, which is the country's most populated province.
Declan, the internal workings of the Pakistani Taliban are pretty intriguing as well. I mean, they usually choose leaders within the Massoud family, as in Hakimullah Massoud and his own father. So what happened this time?
Yeah, this is a major departure for the Taliban. It can be seen in several different ways. The most obvious explanation is that there have been tensions within the Massoud tribe over the succession. This could be a way to settle those arguments or to avoid them flaring into a violent dispute. But if Mr. Fazlullah runs the Taliban from outside the tribal belt, that would certainly make it harder, if you like, for the American drones that have been hunting Taliban leaders over the years, because until now they have operated just within the tribal belt.
The New York Times' Declan Walsh, thanks very much for your time.
My pleasure.
Extremist groups like the Taliban and al-Qaeda are having a field day with all the revelations about the NSA's surveillance methods. That's what the heads of Britain's three main intelligence agencies told lawmakers today. One of the officials even said his spies have intercepted extremists talking about how to switch to safer communication methods. Another British official said spying doesn't work like James Bond. So how would James Bond respond to all of this? Alex Berenson might know. He's the author of the John Wells series of spy novels. Berenson says the NSA revelations prove that reality and fiction are not really that far apart.
I think that, you know, the people out there who said that, you know, that the Panopticon is real have been right. I think, you know, the people.
That's scary.
I keep thinking about, you know, the scene in Enemy of the State or any of these movies that have been made in the last 15 years where it's like, you know, the analysts are in a giant room and there's 83 screens and they can toggle between, you know, anywhere in the world and pull up the data. And, you know, it's very hard to escape the net of surveillance once they have locked in on you. That seems absolutely clear.
How has the spy novel genre changed throughout the last, say, 20 years?
Well, you know, at the end of the Cold War, there was it was a difficult time for the genre. Post 9/11, I think it picked up again. At first, because, you know, I think there was a lot of interest in, you know, Arab and Muslim terrorist organizations and who they were and how we would fight them. I mean, that's sort of the red meat, the red state novel. And now with the backlash, you know, against our own, you know, outsized capabilities. But certainly, it's a good time to be a spy novelist.
Alex, for a fiction writer, what has all this done to your worldview, especially today? You know, these big spy chiefs in Britain who used to enjoy anonymity are all out there in the name of transparency. Will it make writing spy novels a little tougher, a little less mysterious?
I don't think so. I think it gives us more of an opportunity, again, because you can play from inside or outside. Now, there's a little bit more information now about what the capabilities of these agencies are. So you can try to write a novel about what it's like to work inside, especially if you have qualms, you know, especially if you're a Snowden type character. Or you can write, you know, from the outside, which is if the person who is on the run, whether for good reason or bad, and, you know, for that person to survive now, that person has to be exceptional.
So the spy would have to be exceptional, perhaps more like Quantum of Solace, Daniel Craig, James Bond version there. What if we took Sean Connery as James Bond and plopped him in 2013? How'd he react?
You know, it is funny that the guys, I mean, we now rely so heavily on the one hand, the computer guys, right? The software guys that, you know, for lack of a better word, the nerds, the Snowdens. And on the other hand, you know, the CIA has its special operations group, which is essentially paramilitary. But the man in the middle, the Sean Connery, who could handle a gun, who could go to a cocktail party, who could, you know, romance, to use a euphemism, you know, but who was sort of a jack of all trades, that guy is gone, which is sort of sad because. The James Bonds of the world, there's an elegance there that people like.
Alex Berenson's latest book, The Counterfeit Agent, comes out early next year. Alex, thanks so much for your time.
Marco, it was a pleasure.
The big technology news today, of course, is Twitter's IPO. Some worry, though, that going public will cause a company to focus more on figuring out how to turn a profit and less on quirky feeds like the one we're about to tell you. It's called Nine Quarterly. That's N-E-I-N, as in the German word for no. Nine Quarterly has attracted more than 40,000 followers. Not bad. It's got wry tweets on everything from U.S. politics to the sexiness of the German umlaut. Yeah, well, the feed has a big following in Germany, even though most of the tweets are in English and the writer is an American. Caitlin Carroll reports from Frankfurt.
When I read Nine Quarterly tweets, this is the voice I hear in my head.
What's so awesome about nihilism? Nothing.
That's a typical tweet. And here's another.
You call it happiness. I call it acute despair deficit syndrome.
And another.
My doppelganger wants to start resembling other people.
That's my German husband reading Nine Quarterly tweets for me. The man actually writing those is...
Eric Jaruzinski. I'm a German professor at the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia.
Eric Jaruzinski grew up in a small town in Wisconsin. His early experience with German culture came in the form of kitschy folk fests and polka nights. But he got to know the real Germany after spending time in the country and mastering the language.
German for me was a lot like learning math, which I was resistant to. But I learned that it became something very different after I could make the language my own in some form. And in fact, something I encourage my students to do is to make puns in German.
Puns and wordplay are trademarks of the Nine Quarterly Twitter feed. His jokes jump from Marxism to pumpkin spice lattes, all told from the perspective of a depressed German philosopher pining for another time and place. It's a Twitter persona Jaruzinski loosely models on the real German philosopher Theodor Adorno, who died in 1969.
More than anything, I've tried to develop the persona of a lovable misanthrope who comments on most anything he encounters and feels like he has something to say about most everything he encounters.
Jaruzinski started Nine Quarterly over a year ago as a way to relax while writing a book about the concept of transparency.
Essentially, this gave me a voice at a time when I found that there was very little I could put on paper, but there was a lot that I could type into my iPhone.
What started as a lark has turned into something more serious. Jaruzinski is in Germany to meet with publishers to talk about future writing projects. Interest in Nine Quarterly is running high in Germany at the moment, especially among intellectuals. Elke Sloan is a professional translator in Frankfurt. She reads Nine Quarterly for the wordplay.
Well, the plays he does with sort of nihilist statements and the way he twists around famous quotes from philosophy and the way he breaks the German intellectual tradition through this satirical lens is, I think, the hilarity of it.
That got Helmut Wischt laughing, too. He teaches anatomy at Goethe University in Frankfurt.
I think the first tweet, which actually made me follow him immediately, was that famous one, must have been like a year ago, on philosophy.
We've changed the language of that tweet to make it more radio-friendly.
Three lines. First line, ontology.
What the heck?
Epistemology.
Why the heck?
Phenomenology.
The heck.
And in that very moment, I hit the follow button.
Wischt says Jaruzinski's found Germany's enigmatic funny bone. He jokes like an insider.
I mean, he is playing with that. He gives us the feeling that ultimately, finally, there's someone out there in the Anglo-Saxon world who loves and understands us.
That view from the outside is something that Germans crave, and Jaruzinski knows it.
I've had people tell me that's something that they liked, is how does an outsider perceive us? And in particular, an outsider who knows us somewhat. And I think that has something to do with it as well.
Jaruzinski's raising money to support a Nine Quarterly blog he plans to launch at the end of this year. He'll feature writing from many different contributors. He describes the blog this way on his website. It's words, thought, art, umlauts, despair. For The World, I'm Caitlin Carroll in Frankfurt.
You can get Germans too. Check out the Nine Quarterly feed at pri.org/language. Still to come on the show, the other T, The Telegraph, the original Twitter, on The World from PRI Public Radio International.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Medtronic, supporting the American Diabetes Association. November is Diabetes Awareness Month. You can test your risk for diabetes at stopdiabetesnow.com and by reputation.com, dedicated to helping individuals and businesses make a strong first impression on the internet by ensuring accurate search results and authentic online reviews. Learn more at reputation.com or at 1-800-REPUTATION.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. It's deep and it's cold, but Siberia's Lake Baikal is one of the world's great natural treasures. The lake also faces a long list of environmental challenges. And now a local group that advocates for the lake's protection is facing a possible shutdown at the hands of the Russian government. We have our own in-house expert on Lake Baikal. He's Peter Thompson, the world's environment editor and the author of Sacred Sea, A Journey to Lake Baikal.
Last year, Russia adopted a law that requires any NGO that gets funding from outside of the country and that also engages in political activity to register as a foreign agent, which in a place like Russia, with a long history of distrust of outsiders, can be tantamount to being branded a spy. Mm. So it's taking a while for this law to ripple all the way through Russian society. But a few weeks ago in the Siberian city of Irkutsk, a court ordered a group called Baikal Environmental Wave to register as a foreign agent because it says the group meets those two criteria. They get money from outside the country and they engage, according to the court, in political activity.
And I gather the group says it will not do that. It will not register as a foreign agent.
Right. And I spoke by Skype with one of the group's two leaders. Her name is Jenny Sutton. She's a Brit who's lived in Irkutsk near Lake Baikal for almost 40 years and is a Russian citizen. She told me that Baikal Environmental Wave won't register for a couple of very plain reasons.
First and foremost, registering would be a lie. Secondly, it would destroy one's image with the general public.
Because, like I said, being called a foreign agent in Russia can put one in an untenable, if not outright, dangerous position.
Right. So remind us about Lake Baikal. What is it that the Environmental Wave is trying to protect there?
Well, it's an amazing place that would probably be known around the world if it were in a place like the United States. It's the oldest and deepest lake on Earth. It's more than a mile deep.
Wow.
It's the largest lake in the world by volume. It's got roughly a fifth of the world's liquid fresh water in it, which is the same amount as all of North America's Great Lakes combined. It's home to more than 1,000 animals and plants that exist nowhere else on Earth. It's also just incredibly beautiful.
All right. You've made a very convincing pitch to visit Lake Baikal, which you've actually done twice and ended up writing a book about it and some of its biggest environmental challenges. So what are those threats that this group, Baikal Environmental Wave, has been fighting against?
Well, there were two big ones that ultimately Baikal Wave was actually able to help defeat. One was a huge oil pipeline that would have gone through the Baikal watershed and very close to the lake itself. A lot of pressure from Baikal Wave and others helped reroute that a few years back. And then there's been this huge and very nasty paper mill right on the shores of the lake that's been dumping PCBs and other pollutants into Baikal for decades. The Wave was involved in a long and torturous fight to close that factory, and after a lot of back and forth for years, it does seem to have finally shut down for good. But of course, there are still more threats. Among them are mining in the lake's watershed, illegal logging, pollution from tourism and second home development around the lake. And while there are strong laws in the books about protecting Baikal, they're generally ignored.
So they don't want to be foreign agents. What about getting local money? Could Baikal Environmental Wave get by without the support of outside funders and focus on local funding?
I asked Jenny Sutton about that, and the short answer is no. Here's what she said.
There is no tradition in Russia of public support for NGOs. Even Greenpeace, that has got a whole group of people working entirely on fundraising, can only raise something like 10 or 12% of its budget.
All right, Peter, so what's going to happen to Jenny Sutton and her group Baikal Environmental Wave?
Well, she tells me that they're going to appeal the court ruling that they must register as a foreign agent, but that they'll probably lose and that ultimately they'll probably be faced with big fines that they just won't be able to pay, and so they'll have to close. And if that happens, at least for now, Baikal will be left without any significant domestic citizens group fighting for its protection.
The world's environment editor, Peter Thompson, thanks so much.
Thank you, Marco.
The phrase bad hair day. Do people really have 24 hours of their life to find but the strands of protein on their heads? The answer is yes. Getting hair right can be an obsession for some people, especially teenagers. And sometimes that perfect teen hairstyle is considered inappropriate by grown-ups like parents or teachers. That scenario played out recently at COSAT, the public high school in Cape Town, South Africa that we've been following all year. COSAT is a center of science and technology and serves mostly low-income students. But poor or rich, it's all about the hair. Here again is the world's Anders Kelto.
Earlier this week, as I was walking through the school courtyard at COSAT, I noticed something unusual. A lot of boys had shiny, bald heads. I asked a group of ninth graders what was going on, and they led me straight to English teacher Mrs. Godden.
We're just trying to keep to the code of conduct.
The code of conduct, the school's dress code, doesn't allow certain hairstyles, she said. So Mrs. Godden and another teacher forced some students to shave their heads. She said the real issue wasn't hair. It was another problem, one that plagues this low-income township called Khayelitsha.
You know, in Khayelitsha, you have lots of gangs.
Lots of gangs, she said. This school, COSAT, has been relatively immune to the influence of gangs. But when Mrs. Godden saw boys with hairstyles they call uppercuts, basically flat tops, she got worried because she thought that was a gangster hairstyle. Mrs. Godden felt she had to take action. Shaving heads was a first step.
It creates the idea with the kids that they cannot come with street culture into the school.
And Mrs. Godden wasn't just telling kids to cut their hair. She was making them do it, right here. I stepped into her classroom. It looked like a barber shop. One student was shaving another's head while several more waited. There was hair everywhere. A ninth grader named Pambili was having his head buzzed. I asked how he felt about it.
Very, very, very angry.
You don't want to cut your hair?
Exactly.
And how do you think you'll look without hair?
It's ugly.
At first, I didn't have that much sympathy for Pambili and the others. After all, they had violated school rules, right? But then I heard a different side of the story. Lucanio, a junior, said the school's dress code doesn't say anything about hairstyles. It just says students must have their natural hair, meaning no wigs or hair extensions. Lucanio said he didn't understand why flat tops suddenly weren't allowed.
In our townships, we normally do this kind of cut, so we don't get it why it is suddenly becoming wrong.
I asked him and the other boys about gangs. Were there gangs at COSAT? And were uppercuts a gangster hairstyle? They laughed and said no. The teachers were misreading the situation. Mrs. Godden walked into the room. She put her hand on one of the boys' shoulders and told me they were enjoying this process. She said the boys knew she was making them do this because she cared for them. I asked her if this barbershop had a name.
We can call it the Love Shop.
The Love Shop.
The boy with the clippers rolled his eyes and continued shaving his friend's head. For The World, I'm Anders Kelto in Cape Town.
You can see those shaved heads at the Love Shop and a lot more from our year-long look at this South African high school. That's all at PRI.org/schoolyear. This is PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Marco Werman. Today, on his 100th birthday, we remember writer-philosopher Albert Camus.
He was trying to address what a moral path might be, an ethical path, a just path for all humanity. And I think that sounds idealistic, but we need those idealists.
A conversation with novelist Claire Massoud, ahead on The World.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, supporting the American Diabetes Association in their effort to prevent and cure diabetes and to improve the lives of all people affected by diabetes. You can test your risk for diabetes at StopDiabetesNow.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. Mother died today. Or maybe it was yesterday. One of the greatest first lines of any novel. It's from The Stranger, or L'Étranger, by Albert Camus. Remember that book you read in high school and didn't understand? Albert Camus was born 100 years ago today. He becomes more complex when you dig into his background. In his native Algeria, or rather French Algeria, as it was known when Camus was born in 1913, novelist Claire Massoud writes about Camus' complicated relationship with Algeria in the latest issue of the New York Review of Books. Massoud says she's had an interest in Camus all her life.
Well, for me, there's a slightly personal connection, which is that he was a Frenchman from Algeria, a pied noir. So his family were colonials in Algeria, and that's my own father's family's history. They were also pied noir, so it always felt as though he was, you know, the family writer in some way, extended family. But he was both a wonderful writer and a moralist in ways that have great staying power even now.
We'll get into the moral part of Albert Camus in a second. But Pieds Noirs, these French Algerian people, I mean, who were the Pieds Noirs? That means black feet in French, right?
It does. And it was initially a disparaging term because they were seen as, I think, impoverished and uncultured.
Who applied the term?
The French.
Not the Algerians.
France colonized Algeria in 1830. You know, as in many places, the immigrants who came from Europe were people looking for a better life. So they tended to be people without much at home. And those people thought they were born in France, were told that Algeria was a department of France. Unlike the other colonies, it was one of the departments of France, and it was run as a part of France. However, the indigenous Algerians, the people who had been there since time immemorial, were not granted full citizenship.
So in a recent article you wrote for the New York Review of Books on the staying power of Camus' moral force is this amazing picture from 1920 when he was 7 years old, black and white photo, a group of his family in his uncle's workshop. And it really looks like, the way you describe it, that was Algeria at the time, these faces. I mean, how does Camus figure into this whole French-Algerian Pieds Noirs
background? Well, his family was of Spanish origin. His mother was deaf and illiterate. The uncle, who was a barrel maker, was a deaf and largely mute. He and his brother lived with his mom, his uncle, and his grandmother, who ran the household. His father was killed in the first months of the First World War, so very soon after Camus was born. He never knew his father. They had very humble stature in the community in Algiers. They lived in a working-class neighborhood. Almost everybody he knew left school at the age of 11 or 12. And in fact, it was his school teacher in elementary school who went and implored his grandmother to let him continue and go to the high school. And then he again had a mentor in high school who encouraged him to go to university. And so he really came from a background where not even going to high school was obvious.
So how did that kind of rough and tumble background in Algeria, how did that affect Camus' own view of the colonial situation in that country, whether he was French or Algerian, and who had the right to be there, in other words?
Well, I think one of the things that at the time he was seen, at the time of the Algerian War, which the first uprisings were in 1945, the war properly began it was never declared as a war, but the really strong fighting began in 1954, and Algeria achieved its independence in 1962. So it was a long 8-year stretch with a lot of terrorism that is familiar to us now, bombings, massacres, attacks of a kind that we now see in other countries. And in that time, Camus was initially part of a sort of interracial moderate group. There was a moderate leader called Ferhat Abbas with whom he was allied, and they were trying to work for a solution that would allow a French Algeria to continue to exist, but that would allow citizenship and rights for all citizens. Camus had a hard time giving up that vision. I think it was very hard for him to imagine an Algeria that wasn't in some measure French. And one of the things that I tried to write about in the article is he came from a family without a father. And the paternalistic French state was very good to him. Without it, he wouldn't have had an education. Without it, he would never have been Albert Camus. And so I think what he felt was, let's bring that gift to everybody rather than let's sever these two cultures and make them separate. And so he was not at all in tune with his times and was vilified, increasingly marginalized and vilified. And from 1958 onwards, he didn't say anything about the Algerian War. He was not part of the discussion. That said, I think when we look now at what he wrote about it, we realize that even then what he was seeking was justice for everyone, for all Algerians, not just the French in Algeria, but, say, the Jewish community he wrote specifically about justice for the Jewish community who had been there for centuries and ultimately left with the French because there was no place for them in the new Algeria. And he was looking for a solution that would provide rights for everybody. He was beautifully idealistic and painfully out of touch with his times.
Why do you think we should still read Albert Camus today? Does he still kind of scan as out of touch?
No. I think one of the curious things is that he scans as way more in touch. He was a moralist from the get-go. And he was a resistance hero before he was 30. He was a hero for the French people whose memory and reputation were somewhat tarnished by this complicated Algerian situation. But when you stand with 50 years distance and the knowledge that we have now about the complexity of nation building, about the fact that independence isn't a simple good. Independence actually brings with it, look at Egypt right now. It doesn't bring happy answers. It isn't as though, you know, you got rid of Mubarak and now all will be well. It's actually a much more complicated scenario. And I think when you read what he wrote at the time, you realize that he anticipated those complexities more than many of his peers. And he was trying to address what a moral path might be, a just path for all humanity. And I think that sounds idealistic, but we need those idealists.
Well, I love Albert Camus, Claire Massoud, but you've really done a great job in filling in so many blanks for us. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Marco.
Banksy's last art installation in New York is now in custody. The six balloon letters and exclamation point, which together spelled Banksy, were confiscated by police. The elusive English street artist has a knack for attracting the spotlight, exciting some people, infuriating others, and he's not alone in his line of work. Another street artist is making quite a name for himself in northern Spain. He's known around the city of Gijón simply as Señor X. Reporter Jerry Haddon went in search of him and his works.
Like Banksy, who tell his New York fans online where to find his new works, Señor X is guiding me in real time by dropping virtual pins onto a map. I can see them on my phone. And he's gotten me nice and lost in a wasteland of half-collapsed warehouses on Gijón's perimeter.
Filled with old bricks, and I think this is actually asbestos roofing.
I'm looking for what may be Señor X's best-known and least-viewed work, an elaborate stenciling called Life.
To get inside here, I had to lift up a fence, I had to slide underneath, and now I'm inside what may be one of Señor X's urban canvases. Found it. Yes! My first Señor X.
Life consists of a disheveled man's face cold-cocked by the word life itself, causing him to vomit or cough up his insides. It's hard to tell, but the point's clear. In Señor X's view, something's terribly wrong in Spain these days. There's his life-size image out on the edge of Gijón's pier, another stencil, of a businessman with a rock tied around his neck, a clear commentary on how Spain's economy was sunk by real estate speculators, or the public garbage cans labeled bankers and politicians. No explanation needed there. Other works are just plain funny. He painted columns to look like Cuban cigars, and he's done a series of Picassos, as in Pablo Picasso hunched over and spray-painting a wall. In general, folks here are pretty excited about their mystery neighbor's growing notoriety. Señor X's work is stupendous, says Charo Cimas, a ceramics artist working at an outdoor market. It's a way to transmit art to everyone, she says, and it's free. And done on public property, which is why the city, alarmed by the sheer number of Señor X's paintings, has for the last year or so been painting over most of what he does. But if the city thought disappearing his art would make Señor X go away, they were wrong. David Ergüelles, the owner of a local sports store here in Gijón, has a Señor X original on his facade. He actually commissioned it through an intermediary at a local art gallery. It shows a smiling 1950s-style American-looking couple behind an open umbrella. Above, two kids dressed in knickers are spitting down on them. Ergüelles says, a couple of clients have said to me, the day you redo your facade, please call me. They want Señor X's work. It's an amazing piece of realism. People are really starting to follow him, he says. I mean, you're here. There must be a reason for that. As to Señor X's identity? To tell you the truth, Ergüelles shrugs, I barely even saw the guy. He came to do the work, and the very next day he'd finished. He was wearing a gas mask to paint. So I don't know who he is. It's all a mystery. And it's going to stay that way. I know because Señor X tells me. I'm trying to save on the fines, he says, on a Skype call he agreed to after my visit to Gijón. But also, he says, I think a work of art should speak for itself. I don't like to explain it. Señor X says he left Gijón tired of small-town life and the cat-and-mouse game with local officials, which is when he reveals that he's in London. Bigger town, more stuff to stencil on. He's aware he's now on Banksy's turf, but he shrugs off comparisons. Lots of people are doing this style of art, he says. Banksy is the reference point. Everyone knows him, so they always compare to him. It's normal. but I'm not even close to his level. Hard to say, but he's definitely not banking what Banksy banks. For now, Senior X works as a graphic designer to pay his rent. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon, Gijón, Spain.
Did you hear the one about AT&T? It's no joke. The New York Times, citing government officials, says the company is receiving $10 million a year from the CIA to assist with overseas counterterrorism investigations. This allows the CIA to exploit AT&T's vast database of phone records, especially international calls. Now, whether right or wrong, government surveillance goes way back. Here at The World, we like to look at where we've come from and how we got here. In fact, we're starting a new segment we're calling The World That Was. Overseeing that beat is our resident history buff, Chris Wolf. And Chris, what did you find out about all this?
Well, it goes back to the very first electronic media, the telegraph, you know, the old dots and dashes of Morse code, which would be written up and delivered to people as telegrams. In fact, the name AT&T itself started life long ago as the American Telephone and Telegraph Company, although the corporation's changed considerably since then.
What were the problems back then with that kind of surveillance?
Well, the first weak link in the chain is that you're delivering your message in person to a telegraph operator who's going to transcribe it and transmit it to one or more operators and other stations until you get to your destination. So obviously they can leak the information physically. Then you can just literally tap the telegraph wire anywhere along its length and listen into the messages being transmitted. U.S. states introduced the first legislation against this as early as the 1860s, but governments weren't too concerned, especially when national security was an issue. And apparently intercepted telegrams were routinely landing on Abraham Lincoln's desk during the Civil War.
So in the 19th century, were they employing telegraph security consultants who could intervene?
Yes, they were. And literally, you'd just have people come up with codes and ciphers to try and confuse anybody who might be listening in.
So when did mass surveillance begin?
Just about a century ago, around the time of World War I, just before and just after, when countries decided it was worth trying to gather as much information as they could for the obvious, like, national security questions of the time. The main problem, of course, is just how labor-intensive it was before computerization. Here in the States, all interference in electronic and wireless communications was illegal, but U.S. military intelligence wasn't deterred by that. They cut a deal with Western Union in 1920 to be able to look into whatever telegrams they were interested in.
So the U.S. military and Western Union together in 1920. Today it's the CIA and AT&T. You said surveillance then, back in World War I, was mostly to do with national security. Did it work? Was the nation more secure?
Well, let's just qualify it. We're talking about the U.S. and Western democracies here were ostensibly using national security as an excuse for this kind of wiretapping, eavesdropping. Authoritarian states, you know, that were emerging in Europe in the 1920s and 30s used it for much more sinister purposes. Here, the surveillance system was temporarily halted in 1929 by Secretary of State Henry Stimson, new on the job. Some intercepted Japanese military cables land on his desk, and he just takes his glasses off and says, "Gentlemen, do not read each other's mail." Anyway, not a great move for national security, perhaps, and as some historians argue, that may have helped the Japanese achieve surprise at Pearl Harbor just a few years later.
Right, 1941, and Pearl Harbor must have changed a lot of the whole surveillance state, right?
Exactly. All bets are off during World War II because, again, countries are fighting for their survival. But what you find here in the States in the aftermath of World War II is what's called Operation Shamrock, the kind of precursor of the NSA, which is, again, a government agency cutting a deal with the major communications companies to introduce a massively intrusive surveillance system, which lasts into the 1970s when it was shut down amid a huge hue and cry. And that's the time when modern rules and regulations were established, which obviously many people now feel are out of date.
Always wanted to do that. The world's history buff, Chris Wolf, and we'll be checking back with you, Chris, when our curiosity arises, which I got to say is often. So thanks for getting the ball rolling with The World That Was.
You're welcome.
This is PRI, Public Radio International.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Reputation.com, dedicated to helping individuals and businesses make a strong first impression on the Internet by ensuring accurate search results and authentic online reviews. Learn more at Reputation.com or at 1-800-REPUTATION. And by Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention and dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Let's go to a place now we hardly ever hear from, the northern Nigerian city of Kaduna. It's a painfully segregated place. Muslims live mainly in the north, Christians in the south of the city. A shadowy rebel group called Boko Haram exploits that divide, spreading chaos with attacks on schools, churches, and police stations. So Kaduna might sound like an unlikely place to hold an international peace conference, but it's hosting one. Charlie Sennett, founding editor of Global Post, is there, and he says he's met two extraordinary leaders in Kaduna.
They're a tag team. They're called the Pastor and the Imam. Pastor James runs a large Pentecostal church here and has been was very sort of hardline and militant in the mid-90s. This sort of braggadocio is a part of the Nigerian character, and he felt that very way about his faith. And he was really part of a militancy that was emerging at that time. On the other side of town was an imam in one of the larger mosques here who was very similar, also very militant. But the two of them became friends. The two of them have lost many of their own loved ones and those dear to them. In fact, the pastor lost his arm at one point and has an artificial hand. Those two have sort of single-handedly led this community to try to move forward.
So, Charlie, you're in Kaduna for a Forum for Cities in Transition, as it's called. There are delegates there from Kosovo, Lebanon, Iraq, Israel and Palestine, Northern Ireland. Do you have a specific example of where you saw people kind of like stopping and thinking about what they were saying to each other?
One was when the Iraqi delegation was giving their presentation. There was one Sunni municipal leader in Baghdad who talked about how all of the problems that Iraq faces right now all happened after the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003. But you could see his Kurdish counterpart cringing at that and then wanting to come back and talk about the problems in Iraq go quite far back into the persecution of Kurds, 180,000 killed in the Anfal campaign. He began to tell his narrative. And then in a very compelling moment, one of the delegates from Derry stopped them both and said, "This is very common that you're both going to say there was no problem before for one group and that the other group will say there is a long history here. What you need to do is realize that that doesn't get you anywhere. So as long as you fight over where this begins, you can't find your way forward." And you could see, not maybe what you'd call an aha moment, they still looked as tense and in disagreement as ever. But those Iraqis tried their best to say, "Okay, we're here as delegates and we still have a lot to learn." And then observing how the Nigerians watched that process informed them, and they shared that in the meeting.
Charlie Sennett, the founding editor of Global Post in the northern Nigerian city of Kaduna. Thanks a lot for your time, Charlie.
Thanks, Marco.
Check out Charlie's blog from Kaduna at PRI.org. Finally today, the wonderful music of Rio de Janeiro. Each year, the Brazilian city cranks out way more music than we Americans normally get to listen to or even know about. Reporter Beto Arcos was in Rio recently on a sort of musical discovery tour, and he's here to share with us some of what he found.
I've been a fan of Brazilian music, but to be in Rio, it's like being in Mecca. And one of the main reasons I went to Rio was to see a singer named Bibi Ferreira. She's really Brazil's grand dame of theater and especially musicals. Believe it or not, she's 91 years old, yet recently she's been doing a show about the life of Frances Edith Piaf. I'd like to play for you a tune called La Foule, which is a song originally written by two Argentine composers. But Piaf heard it when she toured the Americas in the early 50s. And here she is, Bibi Ferreira, singing it in French and Portuguese.
Je revois la ville en fête et en délire, supportant sur le soleil et sur la joie. Et j'entends dans la musique les cris, les rires, qui éclatent et rebondissent autour de moi. Et au réveil, je vois une fête et une délire, supportant pour un dia de calor. E embora olhando em torno nada vejo, indiferente sou a tudo, seja lá o que for.
Wow, Bibi Ferreira, Beto, sounds like she's nowhere near 91 years old.
I know, she's unbelievable. And by the way, she's going to be at Town Hall in New York on November 13. And yes, she'll be singing Piaf. Wow. It's going to be incredible.
So Rio going a bit retro. I mean, Rio de Janeiro is music. It's also the beaches and tourism. And the music is a big sell for tourists. How big a business is music in Rio de Janeiro?
It is huge. I'd say it's one of the driving forces in Rio, because everyone still goes to Rio to record. All the major studios are in Rio, and it has a big music scene. There's clubs all over the city. It is a happening place, and there are people coming from all over, not just all over Brazil, artists, musicians who want to be part of the scene, but also from all over the world.
And if Rio is the musical capital of Brazil, the style of Rio is samba. For those of us who don't know what samba is, maybe we know it by sound. What is samba?
Think of samba as Brazil's blues, country music, rock, and jazz all combined, and then more. Really, samba is the music through which Brazilians express their joy, their sadness, their defeats, their triumphs. Of the 10-plus samba shows that I saw when I was in Rio at this area called Lapa, the sort of heart of the music scene in Rio, this singer, Joyce Cândido, stood out. She's a natural performer, and she has everything a samba singer needs to hit the big time.
O gosto do amor é o da fruta de bom paladar. O cheiro do amor é um convite, quem vai recusar? Amor bem leve, bem doce, tem gozo, chamego a nos sufocar. Faz nossa vida tem melhorar.
The Brazilian singer Joyce Cândido there, and really good to hear the feel and soul of samba is still alive in 2013, Beto. It'll be fantastic to hear more of your discoveries and the great music you brought back, and you'll have your first report for us next week, right?
That's right. I'll be really, really excited. It's going to be actually a story about this singer that we just heard, Joyce Cândido.
Beto Arcos, who will be sharing more of the things he heard and brought back from Brazil with us in the coming weeks. Great to speak with you, Beto. Thanks.
One more thing, Marco. I'd like you to hear one more tune from a band that I discovered when I was there. I didn't get a chance to see them, but I got their records. This is a band called Orquestra Imperial, and their title of their album says it all, Making Peace with Swing.
A saudade é que me consola. Quando a mágoa não tem mais jeito.
Nice. We'll be hearing more of reporter Beto Arcos and his musical discoveries in Rio throughout the month. You can see this band, Orquesta Imperial, performing on stage at PRI.org. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman, back with you tomorrow.
Quando a mágoa não tem mais jeito, coração rebenta a gaiola, ao sentir que o vão fica estreito.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, Public Radio International, and WGBH Boston, supported in part by the Luce Foundation's Henry R. Luce Initiative on Religion and International Affairs, by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world, macfound.org, by the Annenberg Foundation, and by the WGBH Fund for Environmental Reporting, whose donors include the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting a cooperative approach to solving our critical environmental problems while we still can, and by the PRI Global Reporting Fund, providing in-depth reporting on a diverse array of important topics, including global health. Donors to the fund include Marguerite Steed Hoffman and Blythe Brendan Mann Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.